Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. The subject is chelation therapy, and the latest study on the subject of chelation therapy called TAC, the Trial to Assess Chelation Therapy. I was a part of the study design. We're talking to the study director. He's Dr. Tony Lamas. He's a cardiologist and researcher at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in Miami, Florida. He's a type of doctor who is a trialist, doctors who specialize in doing scientific studies. He's treated patients, but now he devotes his efforts to studying drugs, medical procedures, and in this case, chelation therapy. So part one, we talked a little bit about the background of TACT-1, which did suggest, indeed, that chelation was beneficial. So tell us about TAC-2, and how was it that you actually got the go-ahead to begin planning it?
Well, after TAC-1, it really took, I would say, a good year for all of us who were involved in the analysis of the study to digest what we had come across. Because I really can't overemphasize how extraordinary we felt as conventionally trained cardiologists that this study that was supposed to be negative surprised us. And not only did it surprise us, but every time that we did a different analysis or looked at a particular high-risk subgroups like patients with diabetes, it appeared that the effect size of chelation was even greater. Mm-hmm. So, and that it takes a little time to digest that. So over the first year after the presentation, we were publishing and published four papers just describing exactly what we found. And then at that point, you reach a point where you say, okay, well, now what? I've written this up in the Journal of the American Medical Association and one of the circulation journals, in this journal, that journal. And, and practice isn't really changing. And there's no evidence that Medicare is going to pay for it. FDA, when we went, said, this is great, but you got to do it again. And the heroes in part of this are really the people in the National Institutes of Health, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute, and the National Center for Complementary and Integrative Health. They realized that we really had a tiger by the tail, and that this is something that the public health demands that we settle. That we settle it as future therapy, ripe for investigation and application, or that we say, okay, this study was a fluke. And they were very interested in our doing another study. We were interested in pursuing this to its logical end. Hence, we started talking about TAC-2. But money is tight. The NIH budget had not been increased for umpteen years, on and on. And it's all the usual stuff as you start gearing up to try to get another $20 or $30 million to do a large trial. It usually takes 2 or 3 years. And this one took a couple of years. And what we have gotten is that we've gotten funded for a planning year to see if we can put it all together. And then we will have gotten it together, and then the rest of the funding will come through. So right now, in fact, when we met with the FDA, they recommended that we do another study. They also recommended that we look at the patients. We restrict the study to the patients that had the greatest benefit. And the reason for that is that it is the best place to prove the concept. If we can prove the concept in the diabetic patients, those are the ones that had the greatest effect, then the floodgates will open. And this really will be recognized as a new treatment for cardiovascular disease with a mechanism that is not quite understood, And it'll be not only remarkably good for the health of our patients, but it will also be a very fruitful area to investigate. It's not cholesterol, it's not a new stent, and it's not a new operation. It is something else. That's something.
So I'm curious, did you experience any kind of political currents there? Because we know that there is a general skepticism about therapies that are outside the mainstream, non-pharmacological treatments, treatments that are embraced by the integrative community. Or did you feel that you got very objective, fair shake from the powers that be at the NIH?
The NIH relationship has been a very interesting one. Initially, they participated really quite graciously in the study. They funded it half and half with the integrative medicine folks. Then along the way, there were some problems with National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute not wanting to continue funding it. And then it kind of straightened out. And I would say for the last 10 years, they have been tremendous allies, really good shepherds, both of the public funds and of public health. So they have put out the money that is necessary for us to do a study that will improve health. And these are smart scientists. So I have nothing but good things to say about them. And, and I admire the work they do.
Mm-hmm. That's very, very encouraging.
And I know that what I encountered at NIH is something that was sort of pre-prepped by the alternative medicine community for many years, asking for studies of chelation therapy. These things don't occur in a vacuum. Had I not met with individuals like yourself, Ron, who were open to working with a conventional cardiologist whom you didn't know, then this study could not have happened.
Yeah, there's this great deal of trust involved, and it was a little bit like the U.S.-Iran negotiations for a while, trying to get clear on our priorities.
Yeah, well, I was completely fine because, I met really the leadership of alternative medicine in the U.S., really in the world. And, it was pretty clear when I spoke with you that you were interested in the well-being of your patients. And so we had that in common. What was the difficulty, I think, is that you also had more than that, in the sense that you had a long history of conventional medicine trying to really do you in. And I was a representative of conventional medicine. So it was, I think, really a leap that I'm very grateful that, that ACAM and ICIM and all these organizations took, and we have ended up trusting each other.
Indeed. It could have turned out badly, but fortunately it turned out well. So the other question I want to ask, and this question may make you uncomfortable, you don't have to answer it, is your professional standing within the field. You're a respected trialist. Your livelihood is to compete for grants, sometimes multi-million dollar grants. Did your reputation with the research community go a little bit askew because you embraced a therapy which is thought by some to be a little bit woo-woo? Do they now say, gee, Tony used to be a great trialist, but now he's gone off a little bit the deep end? Or has this enhanced your stature because you look at it objectively?
Well, at this point, I would say that most serious clinical trialists believe that I've run across something unexpected and either admire or are jealous of that fact. Now, when TACT was being performed, you know, the long decade, most of them thought that I was a little wacko.
Right.
Why was I doing that? And why didn't I stick to pacemakers and angioplasties like I had been in the past? So, you know, there were a lot of people who would ask me about TACT and always chuckle. Like, you know, I mean, he's a good guy, but really, you know, he's really quite an eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my reputation seems to have recovered. I mean, if I was eccentric then, I suppose I am now, but...
Okay.
You know, an eccentric with $30 million is okay.
That's a good way to put it. So tell us how TACT 2, if it comes to fruition, if and when it comes to fruition, will differ from TACT 1. What can we anticipate?
Well, the key to TACT 2 really is that it has to replicate TACT 1. We are trying to do exactly what we did before, in patients with diabetes who are the patients that had the greatest benefit. We're not trying to invent. The difference is, though, that this time, because of the interest in NIH for trying to figure out exactly what the heck happened, is that we are going to be collecting blood and urine and looking at metals.
Mm-hmm.
And we are going to also be sending blood and urine to a biorepository. That means that it gets frozen at minus umpteen degrees. And scientists will ask questions that mm-hmm. we haven't thought of yet. And the blood and urine will be there so that those questions can be answered.
So it'll be a study generator, in a sense. You're going to generate a large series of samples that people can, you know, come up with some great ideas on how to explain this phenomenon or study different aspects of it.
Yeah, that they can query. Because, you know, as I said, I mean, the lead and cadmium idea, that's fine, that's great. But maybe it really has to do with some derivative of calcium or something that calcium is changing. Mm-hmm. And somebody else is going to figure that out. That's not me. What I want to figure out is that, in fact, when you give EDTA chelation to diabetic patients and compare it to people who are receiving placebo, diabetic patients receiving placebo, there are fewer heart attacks and fewer deaths. That's my main goal, to create the platform to rediscover that, if it is really there.
Well, let me share with you something that's happening in the trenches here where I practice. In spite of the resounding success of TACT and the positive impact that publication of this data has had, in some ways it's actually been harder for me to accomplish chelation with my patients. I'll tell you why. I'm no longer under threat of getting my license taken away merely for offering this controversial treatment. That's, you know, one of the things that I think is an outgrowth of the TACT studies. At least it won't be illegal to do chelation, or it won't be considered malpractice, or you won't be subject to professional discipline for doing it. But there's a climate of regulation of things that we in the field of integrative medicine use for IVs, vitamin C, for example, and B vitamins, yeah, but also EDTA, that's making it harder and harder for us to access the stuff. The prices have become astronomical. They're waiting lists. There's scarcity. And so, ironically, we have a situation where chelation has been proven beneficial, but it might actually be harder for doctors to administer it and patients to receive it.
Ron, I've heard this multiple times from some of my colleagues who practice chelation and also at alternative medicine meetings. And the regulations really have to do with compounding pharmacies and what you need to do in order to have a license as a compounding pharmacy. And they also have to do with what kind of equipment and regulations you are subject to when you are mixing these things yourself in your own office. If you recall, there was that terrible tragedy where
in Massachusetts.
A compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts was really didn't maintain complete sterile technique and ended up causing serious infection in the sort of backbones of various patients who'd received steroids for chronic pain. And that really got the entire regulatory system moving in a direction that, while it should improve the public health, it also has, like many other regulations, unforeseeable consequences. And the unforeseeable consequences are that many physicians who were mixing drug successfully and safely for many years are now no longer allowed to do so. And compounding pharmacies that had been mixing for many years safely now have so many regulations that the price of everything goes way up. Disodium EDTA also has become harder and harder to get. So it really is something that I've been fortunate because I'm working under an FDA IND, and I've kept in touch with FDA. So we've not had difficulty acquiring the appropriate reagents, medications, and so on. But there is a paradoxical effect that is, I think, unrelated to TACT and really related to compounding pharmacy issues. I hope that we can work our way around that in some way, because I see it as potentially limiting patients' access to medications.
Indeed. So TACT 2, if it commences, will begin when?
It'll be in the fall of this year. I'm hoping that we will enroll our first patient in September or October.
Are you taking enrollment at this point? If there are people listening who have, say, a relative who has a heart attack and has diabetes, would they be a candidate for TACT?
Oh, they would be, but we can't really enroll anyone until, you know, until roughly that time.
So stay tuned.
But right now, you know, yeah, stay tuned. I mean, basically, we're the only game in town for that. So, and we enroll patients. Patients have to be at least 6 weeks after a heart attack. On average, our patients that had their heart attack 3 or 4 years prior to enrollment. So these were stable coronary patients. And it still improved them. I mean, that's really the amazing thing, that it still improved patients who were stable. The trial itself will be in patients, as I said, who've had a prior heart attack, who have diabetes defined by high blood sugar or treatment for diabetes, either insulin or oral treatment, and whose kidney function is pretty good. Not perfect, just pretty good. And who are not intolerant to any of the components that were given, and who are willing to participate and come to the study visits. We will be giving 40 infusions over the course of a year.
So it involves sitting in a doctor's office for 3 or 4 hours at a time, 40 times,
yeah,
possibly a couple times a week, and it's a kind of a drawn-out procedure.
Yeah. That's really what's extraordinary about this, is that if this study is positive, then the floodgates of research from pharmaceutical companies will open. And, you know, we always say it's easy to say bad things about big pharma, but I can tell you that within a year there's going to be an oral chelating agent that will mimic EDTA.
Wow.
If the study's positive.
Well, that's an exciting prospect.
Yeah, exactly. And it'll help patients.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, I mean, just think now of what's going on in Flint, Michigan. With the lead intoxication.
Yes, big story.
They're talking about children and this and that. But what are going to be the chronic effects on the adults that have been exposed? Those individuals have high lead levels. Lead lives in the blood and blood cells for about a month, and then it travels into bone, where it sits for about 30 years. When it's in bone, it leaches out slowly and damages the heart and arteries and nervous system. So that is an entire population.
And you know what
needs to be getting let out.
What some of my older patients find strange, they say, well, you know, I'm not exposed to lead. How come I have high levels of lead? And I say, well, you know what happens is women at 50 or men at 65 or 70 start losing bone. What ends up happening is, where does the lead go? It goes back out. It was staying in that bone bank for a while. But as you begin losing bone, that repository has given up its stores of lead. It may have been accumulated during the era when there were less stringent controls over lead. There was lead in paints. There was lead in gasoline. So these people from the, you know, the 50s and 60s, they were exposed.
Yeah, well, these people from the 50s and 60s is me, you know?
So, exactly.
You know, I have some personal concerns about lead. But it's just we live in an industrialized world. It is naive to think that if you eat organic food and you do this and you do that, you are going to be free of toxic metals. They are truly everywhere. And what we do with them and how they affect us is really part of the landscape of our health. And that's really what I think we may learn from TAC, that we do need to get these metals out because they do not belong in the body and they're toxic. There's a lot of basic science that supports that. There's epidemiological work that supports that, studies of populations. And now we have a clinical trial that supports that. So that's pretty, I think it's pretty striking. It makes a very nice story. And in fact, when I present it now at places like the Brigham and Women's Hospital at Harvard, I'm going to Cedars-Sinai at the end of this month. Actually, on February 1, I'll be giving grand rounds there. I've presented at the University of Pittsburgh. What's interesting is that the older doctors look at me and say, wow, that's pretty amazing. I thought chelation was terrible. And the younger doctors, residents and medical students, they haven't quite acquired that loathing, the fear and loathing of chelation.
Right.
So they kind of wonder, well, why aren't we doing this now? And that's when you see the survival curves in this study, and they're up on a slide, it's very hard to explain that to a medical student. Why
this isn't standard therapy.
That.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why can't I order that?
Progress is slow. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? Are there resources that people can access? Is there a website that describes the TAC study or the work? I've written several articles on TAC myself. You can find them at drhoffman.com. Can you direct patients to other resources?
Well, I think that to look at the any TAC literature, all the papers that I've written are open access. So it's easy enough to look for my name in the National Medical Library in PubMed, and all the papers are there. Many of them are written in a way that is accessible to individuals who are not medical, and I think that the key is to seek information from your open-minded physician. You have to have an open-minded physician. And
not necessarily integrative, but like you, open-minded, because I think you would characterize yourself as a conventional physician, but open-minded.
Yeah. And, you know, and that can be, Ron, unfortunately, that can be a challenge, as you know.
Indeed. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today, Tony Lamas. And I congratulate you on your work. You've been a really wonderful ally to work with. And we hope for your great success in continuing this line of research. We hope that TAC2 also continues to support this therapy, which we think really has great potential. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.